All right, and so, and again, this animation that I'm playing here is a collection of functions, including this Weierstrass function. It's kind of a family, but we wrote down one of them that are very hard to get your hands on without this picture of obtaining them as a limit of other functions. Okay. All right, but anyway, so let me get back to the whiteboard. Okay, and so let me just start by indicating a little table of which types of properties are preserved by which types of limits, because we have basically three types.
Professor, a lot of us can't hear you.
Okay, does that work?
Yes.
And is it? Okay. All right, so let me, can you still hear me? Okay, good. So let me try once again with the other device that I'm using for my whiteboard, see if I can get that to work. Okay, so now you can both hear me and see the whiteboard, I hope. So that's okay, very good. Sorry about that. All right, sorry. Okay, so let's see. So we were talking about property. I was talking, and some of you could hear me, about properties that are preserved by the various types of limits that we have. So there are three essential types of limits that we've been talking about and we'll continue to talk about, and those are the point-wise, the uniform, and this C1 norm, which we'll focus on more today. And so the properties that we have seen so far involve boundedness, and I'll write down an example of showing that boundedness is not preserved by point-wise, and we've already seen one. Boundedness is preserved by uniform convergence. That was theorem 9.13. And the other two properties that I want to look at are continuity and differentiability. Okay, and for a continuity, we will also find examples that we call these GN that are not preserved by pointwise convergence. But we proved right at the end of last time, theorem 9.16, that it is preserved by uniform convergence. Of course, C1 convergence requires both uniform convergence and uniform convergence of the derivative. So it's so these properties are also preserved just because it's an even stronger condition than the uniform convergence. And the new one is going to be differentiability today. And so let me say, I'll find an example here where pointwise convergence is not, even uniform convergence does not preserve differentiability, H sub n. But the theorem, the main theorem for today is going to be this 9.18, which says that C1 convergence is the correct type of convergence, or at least it's sufficient to preserve this differentiability, which is what we've been looking at. And so let me just remind you of a few examples. Actually, maybe people can remember some. These are all examples that we've seen before. So let's say f sub n of x. All right, so let's see. So can people think of a sequence of bounded functions that converge to something that's not bounded pointwise? These are some we looked at a couple times already. Okay, well, let me just start with this. Yes, exactly. That's one of them, and it's very similar to the one I'm going to write down. I'm going to write down one that takes a slightly smaller number of characters, but otherwise it's exactly the same type of example as the one you mentioned there. And it's the one that's 1 over x plus 1 on n, like so. Okay. And this is in... the functions from 0 to 1, say. Okay. All right, and it converges to a 1 over x pointwise, and this is a bounded, and this, of course, is not bounded. Okay, so this is the sort of thing that we see up here. It does not converge, and it does not converge uniformly, but not uniform. Okay, and now we can prove that it does not converge uniformly just by using our theorem 9.13, which says that were it to converge uniformly, then the fact that these are bounded would force that to be bounded. Okay, so we know it can't be uniform. Okay, and similarly, we have examples for the other x's here. So I said I would use the name gn for this one. And so we want something where we have a sequence of continuous functions that prove something that's not continuous. And our basic example that I showed right at the beginning when we had examples is this x to the n in the functions on the closed interval 0, 1, okay? And so this converges pointwise to g of x, which is just 1 when x is equal to 1 and 0 otherwise. Okay. And of course, these are all continuous, and this is not continuous. Okay, so that's an illustration of this phenomenon here. And so once again, by this theorem 9.16, we know that this cannot have been converging uniformly. Okay. And then for the third example, we want to say that actually uniform convergence is not sufficient to preserve differentiability. So actually, can anyone remember an example where we have uniform convergence for these HNs, but the results, and these Hs are all differentiable, but the final limit is not?
Square root of x squared plus 1 over n.
Exactly. And that's, to me, the easiest example to keep in my mind whenever I'm run into this kind of a situation. Exactly. And so this approaches the absolute value, which is not differentiable, even though it approaches it uniformly. But this theorem 9.18 is going to tell us that it does not approach it in C1. So that's what we're going to do next. All right, so I think then what I want to do is just write down the theorem and go through the proof. It's a little bit tricky to follow all the logic and also to remember all the things that we have that'll go into it. So it's going to be a mean value theorem proof, okay? And so bear that in mind. Let me write down the theorem. And then I'll remind you of the different bits that we're going to make use of, and then I'll assemble those to actually get the proof. So, and also I'm going to split the theorem into two parts, so it goes as follows. So if we have a function which is a sequence of differentiable functions. So if fn is a sequence in the differentiable functions on some interval a, b. All right, and so remember the idea here is we're going to be thinking about this C1 norm, and that means that the derivative has to converge uniformly and the function has to converge uniformly. So in particular, we need to be able to take derivatives for that to even make sense. Okay, so that's where we're going to start, with things that are differentiable. All right, and then there's this kind of odd condition, which is that we have some point, any point inside of AB for which the sequence of values is also convergent. So these are just numbers now. So I want f sub n at c to converge as numbers. Okay, so these are just real numbers. All right, so this is one particular point. Okay, then, and of course, the other thing we need is that the derivatives also converge. F prime sub n converge uniformly. And since they converge uniformly, I might as well give a name to the thing they converge to. And let me give it a name. Let me call it g of x. So that's what we've got. The derivative converges uniformly. And the at one point, the values converge. Those are our two criteria. OK, so then we're going to get two facts. One of them you're going to prove and one I'm going to prove. So one of them is going to be a homework problem, which I'll assign after class today. And so this one says that if you are in this situation, then not only is it true that this value converges, but every one of them does, and they do it uniformly, okay? So then homework, Fn as a sequence of functions converges uniformly. And we'll give it a name something. Since it converges, we might as well give it a name, and we'll call it F. So in particular, it converges pointwise, but you're going to prove it converges as uniform. What I'm going to do right now is prove 9.18. And that says that not only does this converge to some function, to the f's, but the f primes converge to some function, but the function that g is actually the derivative of f. Okay, so that's the other thing. G of x is equal to f prime. So notice what this says. So it says that if we have a sequence that is converging, so that the derivative is converging uniformly and the function is converging uniformly, so we're over here in this C1 norm convergence, then the resulting limit is a derivative. In particular, it's the derivative of that. So not only do we see that it's a derivative, and that this is differentiable, but we can write down what its derivative is. So you can see it either way. You can either see that this one is a derivative and we know what is a derivative of, or you can say this one is differentiable and we know what its derivative is. So you get both things. Okay, anyway, let me just prove this. All right, so as I advertised, we're gonna make use of some things. So let me just recall the facts that we have that we're going to make use of. So I'm just going to assemble a bunch of facts that seem unrelated to where we're headed, and then we're going to actually use them to put it together. All right, so let's just recall what we have. So one. So if we have that the derivatives are converging uniformly to G, we know that. What does that tell us? That for every epsilon greater than zero, there exists some m depending only on that epsilon. Okay, so that whenever I take two numbers, little n and little m, that are at least a big M sub epsilon, and any point C in this, let me call it P actually, P in this interval AB, then we have that, well, two things. So first of all, it converges. So we have that the difference between F sub N at C and G at C is small. And actually, for the convenience of this proof, I'm going to take small to be epsilon over 5. Okay.
That'd be P.
It would be P. Thank you so much. Okay. So that's one thing. And remember that if something is convergent, that's equivalent to being Cauchy. So I also get the Cauchy statement, and I'm going to use both of them. So let me write both of them down. So I also have that, which makes sense. There was a little premonition here because I wrote down 2n and m here. So I'm going to use both of them here. So f sub n of p minus f sub m of p in absolute value is also less than whatever. And the whatever, again, I'm going to take to be epsilon divided by 5. Okay. So that's a fact that we have. All right. So two. So we also know that F sub N is pointwise approaching F. And actually, we know that it converges uniformly, but I'm only going to use the pointwise part, and let me just emphasize that. So uniformly and hence pointwise. Okay, so if it's converging point-wise, then that means at each point it converges. So what that tells me is that whenever I have an epsilon greater than zero, and I have a point, actually, let me give to myself 2 points because I'm going to make use of that. So let me have an X and a P in AB. I can do that, and so I will. Then there exists some number N, in, depending on that epsilon and the points that I want for it to work at, so X and P, so that whenever I take little n to be bigger than or equal to this capital N, epsilon N P, then we have, well, it's converging point-wise. So we have that the difference between F sub N at P and F at P is small. Okay, but this time I can take small to depend on any of my incoming data here, right? So I have all this data by the time I choose this F, this N. And so I'm actually gonna take it to be small compared also to the X and P. So I'm gonna take it to be less than not just epsilon over five, but epsilon over five times the difference between P and X. So is it clear that I can do that? That I can choose, I've already fixed my X and my P. All right, before I have to choose n, so I just choose n so that the so that it works for this number, whatever that number happens to be. Okay. So I can do that. And then I'm going to do the same, I'm going to require the same thing for x. So f sub n at x minus f at x is also less than the same number. Okay, so there are 2 points at which it's well approximated in that sense. Okay, so that's two facts that I have. I'm going to get four facts. So the third fact I'm going to have here is, let's see. I know that Fn is differentiable. So Fn of x is differentiable. Right, that's what it meant to have this sequence be here in D1, right? So that is differentiable. So it has a derivative. And so that means that, so is Fn minus n. Differentiable, and that's the one I'm gonna end up using. So let me write it that way. That tells me that by the mean value theorem, okay, that I can get for every one of these n and m, okay, and any pair of points x and p, so these are in n, and these are in my interval AB, okay? Then there exists, so remember what the mean value theorem tells me. It gives me some point between the X and the P where the derivative agrees with the difference quotient. So that's what I'm gonna write down. Okay, so there exists this zeta, depending on N and M and X and P, and this is between, X and P. Okay, with the property that the difference quotient is equal to the derivative, but I'm going to apply that to this function here, which is the difference of the two functions. Okay, so let me just write that all out. It becomes kind of a long formula, but it's the one that comes up in my calculation. So that's why I want to use it. So this is Fn minus Fm. That's the function I want. I'm going to take its difference quotient. So I'm going to apply it at x and subtract the same function fn minus fm applied at p divided by x minus p. So that's a difference quotient, right? And the claim is from the mean value theorem, that's the same as its derivative. So fn minus fm, remember this is just a long notation for a single function, and then I take its derivative and evaluate that at my zeta. Okay, so again, is that fair? Once again, all I did was I took this very long phrase here, fn minus fm, and thought of that as just a single function, okay, and just plugged it into my usual setup for the mean value theorem. All right, all of a sudden, one more fact that I want to corral, and then we will assemble these into the proof. So four here. All right, and this one said that each fn is a differentiable again, so we're going to make use of that again. So again, fn of x is differentiable. So this time I'm going to write down that it has a derivative and that it has the right derivative. So that tells us that whenever I take one of these n's, so this is an n, and a point p, in AB, and some epsilon greater than zero, okay? Then we have, for all epsilon there exists delta, so there's a delta depending on this data, so n, p, and epsilon, okay? So that whenever I take the absolute value of x minus p less than delta, so just our usual limit rule, then we have, and the limit for the derivative is the difference quotient. So we have the difference quotient, so f sub n at x minus f sub n at p divided by x minus p, so that's the difference quotient, and the limit of that difference quotient is supposed to be the derivative, and that's all I'm trying to write out here, so that's equal to f prime at p up to epsilon, okay? Oh, sorry, and once again, let me say which I want here. I'm actually gonna ask for epsilon over five. Okay. So they're all gonna stick together, and that five is supposed to be a little bit of a hint of how many pieces are gonna be involved, so you can sort of see where the proof is going. Okay, so, is everyone happy with the fact that at least these four things are true, even if it's not clear why they're helpful for where we're going? All right. So now I want to assemble them to get a proof. So use 1 through 4 for the proof. So let's just indicate what it is we're trying to show. So the goal is to show that the derivative of f is equal to g. So to do that, we need, let me just write it here. So f prime is equal to g, or in other words, that means that whenever I have a point p in this AB, so I want to say that it's got the right derivative at that point, okay? And I have an epsilon greater than zero. Okay, then we need to show that there exists some delta so that whenever I take x less than delta away from p, we have that the difference quotient for f is within epsilon of g. Fx minus fp over x minus p minus g at p in absolute value is bounded by epsilon. That's the goal, right? So this is what we want here. Okay. All right, so let's try to get that. Okay, so all right, so let me just write down the answer. All right, and then we'll see, check that it works. All right, so okay. All right, so I'm going to just write down exactly what I had over here. So I have for all t and epsilon. Just copying. Okay, but now I'm going to say what this delta is equal to. Okay, and it's going to be exactly the delta that I had up here. Sorry, let me get the right delta here. There are two deltas here, right? Sorry. This delta. So notice the difference between these deltas. This delta has these four indices. This delta has these three. So I'm going to use the delta from number four. Okay. So so this I'll just note that here. So this will be the delta from four here. Okay, and if it's going to be from four, then I have to tell you which subscripts to use. All right, and so it's going to be the delta that is associated with some n and p and epsilon. So p and epsilon are my p and epsilon here, so that's clear. But which n am I going to use? So the n I'm going to use is the m sub epsilon, which comes from up here. Okay, so let me just write those out. So this is a m sub epsilon. And then P and epsilon. And let me note once again where this comes from. So this M sub epsilon is from number one. Okay, so I can do that, right? So it's well-defined. M sub epsilon is some number. And for each number and point P and epsilon, I have some delta. Okay, so it's well-defined. So everything is at least allowed. Okay, and then I'm going to check. And what I need to check is right over here that for all of these x's, I have this equation. Let me label that equation so that I have a name for it. Okay, so I want to check star. Check for all x. Less than this delta away from P, we have equation. So I hope everyone's still with me. So that's if I succeed in doing that, then I win, right? So that's my goal. Okay, so I told you all the steps. All right, so let me try. So now it's going to get kind of big. All right, so let me do that. So all right, so compute. All right, so I'm going to start with this thing that I'm interested in here. So the difference quotient, f of x minus f of p over x minus p, minus my g at p. Okay, that's the thing I care about. And I'm going to do the usual game of adding and subtracting. This time we're doing it a bunch of times. Okay, so I'm going to end up with five terms. All right, so this is going to be less than or equal to. Okay, and so now I'm going to start adding and subtracting things. All right, so so the first thing I'm going to take is this, just leave the first term alone. So just leave that difference quotient, f of x minus f of p over x minus p. So that term has to still be there, so it is. And now I'm going to add and subtract f sub m of x, the difference quotient of f sub m. Okay. And add and subtract it. And then I'm going to add and subtract the difference quotient f sub n. So I subtracted it, and I have to add it back. All Okay, and the difference quotient f sub n, I want to be related to the to the derivative at of f sub n. Oops, that's supposed to be n. To the derivative at of f sub n at p. Okay, so I'm going to add and subtract that. Okay, so far that's, and then I'm actually done. So, and then I have to finish up with the term that it lives here. So I have to put that back, and then I've got everything. So g of x, g of p, sorry. Okay, so at least I hope you believe that that's allowed, right? So I didn't do anything unfair. It's just a little bit odd, okay? All right, and so now I'm just going to, sorry. But the other thing that's missing is I have to look at what I've chosen here. So I have a P, I have an epsilon, I chose a delta, and I have chosen an X. But in here, there's also M's and N's, so I have to indicate what those are, okay? So with, all right, so I'm going to take the N to be equal to this M sub epsilon above, okay? And now I have to tell you what M is, and then I'm done. So a little M is going to be equal to, okay, the other thing that I had, I guess I scrolled it off, I apologize, but this one here, this capital N epsilon XP, and then I'm done. So this will be equal to N epsilon XP. All right, so now everything makes sense, right? I have an N, I have an M, and so my formula all makes sense. And then I just compute. So this absolute value that I was interested in, this difference quotient, just copying f of x minus f of p divided x minus p minus g of p, just exactly copying what I had above, all right, is less than equal to, okay, and I'm going to split it into this first one, I'm going to split into two terms. So I have f of x minus f sub m of x divided by x minus p. And notice that that's related to the requirement that I had up here, that I have this size of x minus p times the epsilon. So that's where that's going to come handy. All right, I have this x minus p down here. All right, and then another copy of that. So plus, except that p, f of p minus f sub m of p divided by x minus p, and once again, that was what I demanded here, right? That the difference fn minus f p and fn minus fx were bounded, so that this will be epsilon over 5. All right, and then the next one is, okay, so now I can use my mean value theorem, so number 3 here, which said that this difference quotient, well, that's exactly what I have over here, right? That's exactly this difference quotient, is the same as one of these derivatives, all right? So I'm going to make use of 3 here to get that this is equal to the absolute value of f prime of n minus f prime at m. Actually, maybe I'll write exactly as I did before. So I'll put just a single prime on the outside. Same. Evaluated at my zeta. Okay, and I guess I should say exactly with zeta so that I'm pretty precise here. So this is exactly the zeta that I got from over here. Right, so it involves n, m, x, and p. Okay, and so let me just notate in red. So this is from 3. That I wrote previously.
Okay, let's see. So how are we doing here? So we have dealt with this term and this term, and then we're left with these two, and those we're just going to leave like they are. This is the difference quotient and the derivative, and this is the uniformly convergent derivative to the G. And so then we're done. So then I'll just write them out again, but I'm just going to write epsilon at the end of all this. So then this is plus, just copying. So f of x minus f of p, the standard difference quotient divided by x minus p. Sorry, I'm just copying. So there should be subscript n. I'm just copying this line. This line down here. It's all good. Okay. So so there should be just exactly what is written up there. So those are fn's minus the derivative of fn at p plus this last term, which is the difference between f prime sub n at p and g at p. Okay, and so this is then less than epsilon over 5 plus epsilon over 5, et cetera. As is our goal. Okay, so at this point, it just amounts to running around and checking that all my n's are less than whatever they're supposed to be to make those five things true. That was kind of lengthy. Any questions about how that proof works? Is it clear that you could now go through and check that each of these inequalities is true, that you know, that each one just satisfies the rules it's supposed to? Okay. All right, then let me just try a few examples so you can kind of see how to play with these things. In fact, maybe I'll give you a couple minutes to try it on your own, but let me try the following thing. So recall the picture that I had. Let's see if I can make this work without crashing my machine, but I should be able to show it to you again. Right, so as you recall, there's this function. Well, I'll just write it down. So we have this W of X, the Weierstrass function. Which is a limit. Of these approximations, F sub N of X. Which was the sum, J equals, actually, I remember starting at 1, let me start at 0, which is actually the one that's graphed. They're actually pretty similar functions, but that's the one I have a graph of. So from a J equals 0 up to N, X to the 2 to the minus J times the cosine of 3 to the J X. All right, so that was our sequence of functions that converged to this kind of pointy thing. That I gave a graph of last time. So I claim that a W of X is a derivative. Okay. Actually, on all of R. All right, so there are two ways to see this. So fact, which we will prove much later, every continuous function is a derivative. Okay, and we can use theorem 9.16 like I did last time to show that W is continuous. Right, which we got by noting that each of these functions, f is continuous, and these converge. These are uniformly Cauchy, and therefore converge uniformly to this W, and uniform convergence preserve continuity. Okay. Now, but I want to prove without using this theorem, this big theorem that we haven't proved yet, that this is a derivative. So, but now we use 9.18 instead to show that W of X is a derivative. Okay, so actually, now it's been a lot of talking here. Maybe people can try to figure out what's going on. So if you look at this theorem 9.18, how would I use that to show that my function w is a derivative? So notice the upshot here is that something or other is a derivative, right? It says that this g is a derivative. So how could I prove that w is a derivative using this theorem? Let's see how I might go about that. So the upshot here is that something is a derivative, g. And what is that g? The g was the uniform limit of my fn primes. So what I would need to do is find some f's, okay, so that their derivatives converge to g. And the only other thing I have to check, just one little thing, is this fact that at one point it converges. That's the only other thing I need. And then I'm done in good shape. That's what this theorem is giving me. Does that make sense?
Did you say that one more time?
Yeah, let me say it exactly. Let me just say it exactly one more time. So the goal is to show that W is a derivative, and the theorem says something is a derivative, this G. So we're going to make that G into our W, and then we're done, right? Then we found that it's a derivative. Okay. Now, what is G? G is the uniform limit of Fn primes. So what I need to do is to find, so I need Fn's with this property, Fn prime converging to W. And the only other thing I have to check, I do have to check one other thing, and that is that I need this at some point, my favorite point, I get to choose it. Any one point, I need that it converges. So that's usually the easy part. So the tricky part is going to be to find a sequence of functions fn so that fn prime converges to my w. Okay. All right. So now that that structure is there, can anyone see what the fn's are going to be? It's unfortunate that I have called this f. Let me rename it. Because it's the wrong answer. Okay, so what should my fn's be so that their derivatives approach W.
Should it be some sine function?
Yes, exactly. Right. It should be some sine function. And so it's going to be a sum. And as you say, it's going to be a sine. And the criterion, the goal, of course, was to get this derivatives to converge to W. And we know something that converges to W. These functions up here converge to W, right? So if those are my derivative, then I'm in good shape. Okay, so is that enough now for people to be able to figure out which sine function I want here? Or which constant goes here?
Yeah, so I think you're going to want just 3j times x in the sine, and then it would be 1 over 2 to the j times 3 to the j on the outside.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So we're going to keep this 2 to the minus j just like we had before here, and like you said, we're going to end up with a 1 over 3 to the j in there, or another way to write that is a 6 to the minus j here. That's exactly right. So does everyone understand where he got that and why that is going to work? So this means that gn of x that I have up above is now equal to f prime n of x. That was how it was selected, right? So that it had that property. And so the by 9.18, this limit, so the fn's converge uniformly to some, we call it W tilde, and W tilde prime is equal to W. So this W tilde is now differentiable, and the W is not. So I'm out of time, but let me go back to that animation because that is an indication of how this works. Okay, so you guys see the animation now. So that is cycling between what happens. You see where it's smoother. That's where we have constants more like this 6 to the minus j, so it's differentiable. And then as those constants move along toward more like the 2 to the minus j, then it gets spikier and it's no longer differentiable. So that's the that's what we're seeing happen in this animation. And we just saw that in our computation that we built a function in this funny way that was in fact differentiable, and we even know something about its derivative. It's this W that we looked at before. Anyway, that's a picture of what we did. I'm out of time, but so I'll stop the recording and answer questions. Next time we will talk a little bit more about the sort of notational setting for this before switching back to power series as examples.